Well, hello everybody, and let's get started. Welcome to this course. My name is Lenny Zeltzer. I'm going to be your instructor for the next 4 days, hopefully. And we're going to be talking about malware analysis. I want to make sure everybody's in the right room. This is the reverse engineering malware course. You should have gotten 4 books when you signed up for this and registered. So if you don't have 4 books, you're missing some. And believe it or not, we're going to get through all these materials by the end of 4 days. And I think you'll have a pretty good idea about the content within these materials. Today we're going to start with book one. So you got a book per day. Book one is what we're going to be focusing on today. The schedule for the day, if you're not familiar with the standard SANS conference schedule, the schedule is that we're going to begin at 9 o'clock, and every morning we have a break at 10:30 for 20 minutes. There's going to be some snacks for us outside. Our lunch break will begin at 12:15 for an hour and 15 minutes. Then we're also going to have an afternoon break at 3 o'clock, and we're going to wrap up the day at around 5 o'clock. So I'm never going to hold you here after 5 o'clock. Although sometimes on some days we'll finish a little bit earlier, depending on how the pacing of that day goes. I handed out a DVD that we're going to be using throughout the course. You don't need to do anything with the DVD right now. I'm going to give you some time later this morning and instructions for what to copy where and what tools I need you to set up. So I allocated some time just for that before lunch. And in fact, this is a very, very much a hands-on course. But this morning, for the first 2 hours or so, you don't need your laptops, because I want to go through the fundamental approaches of malware analysis, want to make sure I show you the framework that we're going to be using, and unfortunately that means you're going to be mostly listening to me talking about this stuff. But the rest of the course, for the most part, is going to be us doing things in the lab that you're going to set up. You don't need to connect to the internet for this course. In fact, it's better that you not connect to the internet. We're going to be fully isolated within your laptops, but if you get phone calls throughout the day, I understand if you need to step out to take that call. I understand we've got jobs that are happening outside of this hotel, so that's not a problem if you've got to join a conference call. So that's as much as I want to say about the introduction about the course. I do this sort of stuff because I like it. It's very interesting. It's very challenging to me. There's always something new to learn about malware analysis, because malware authors don't stand still. They keep developing new techniques to protect their code, and we, the researchers, come up with new tools and new approaches for how to bypass their approaches, and so this kind of an arms race continues. As my day job is working as a security consultant, so I see all sorts of environments, and so I try to collect my stories and my samples when I see them at my clients, when I see things on the internet. I'm also a volunteer incident center, I'm a volunteer incident handler at the Internet Storm Center. So people send us all sorts of cases and malware to look at. So that's really what I use to create exercises and stories throughout this course. So here's our roadmap for today. We're going to begin with a course introduction. And I got to say that those of you who have done some malware analysis before, for you, today might feel a little bit slow. But I think it's a necessary evil, because I want to make sure that regardless of your background and the type of work that you've been doing, we are working within the same framework, because I think that framework will be useful for you to build your expertise upon. And those of you who have not done much malware analysis, well then, for you, this is going to be probably very informative. But even those of you who have done some reverse engineering before, I have a feeling that you're going to see some tools, some approaches that I'm sure we'll supplement your toolkit. So we're going to start by talking about the general approaches of malware analysis. I'm going to walk you through how I typically set up my malware analysis lab, and then I'm going to take you through an example, and that's going to be our first half of the day. Though at the end of that first half, I'm going to give you some time to install the tools in your lab. And the second half of today, after we come back from lunch, is going to be all hands-on, because I'm going to give you a malware sample, and we're going to walk through its analysis together. So this is really when you're going to get a chance to experiment with the tools that I'm talking about right now. So this is a pretty technical course, and my goal is to make you better malware analysts, because malware analysis is becoming such a key part of any incident response, any kind of a forensics investigation. Malware is found on systems all the time. So this is very complementary to the incident response and other forensics training that SANS offers. Of course, I won't be able to teach you everything there is to know about this sort of stuff. We only have 4 days together. But my hope is that those of you who have not done malware analysis will walk out of this class and will feel that it's something within your reach. With a bit of practice, this is something you can do. It's not unreachable. And those of you who have done this work before, my hope is that you're going to walk out with this class with some new ideas about improving your approaches, with some new tools, and with more practice that I think we'll go through as the days progress. So we're going to be focusing on Windows-based malware and on malware that runs within the browser. So JavaScript malware we're going to look at tomorrow, for example. But this is to say that we will not be looking at malware that targets OS X or Linux platforms. I just don't see it very frequently, so when it comes to deciding how to strategically use our time, well, I'm focusing on Windows because that's the most targeted platform, and frankly, that's where my expertise lies. And we'll be looking at some assembly code and some packet traces, so definitely not a... It's a technical course, that is to say. So I want to set your expectations straight. And I want to start off with a situation, a scenario, that I think is common to the way a lot of these malware incidents begin. And by the way, those of you who sit too far in the back, if you at some point cannot see the details on the screen, we do have two seats available here at the table up front. So here's the situation. This particular scenario was documented on the incidents mailing list. And an administrator noticed the system was misbehaving. He noticed that it was running an unfamiliar process called srvcp.exe, and he noticed that that process was listening on port TCP 113. Anybody familiar with 113? Yes. It's the IDEMS protocol in many cases used as a way of authenticating the user. Even though as a protocol, it's very, very primitive. The way that protocol works, we've got a seat up front here. And I think you prefer it further back? Would you? Yeah. No, I know. I come to these conferences. I got the little kids at home, so when I get to sleep through the night, it's kind of a nice thing, so yeah. So 113 is a port that some programs still use, mostly IRC, to try to authenticate the user. And the way they work is that a client connects to the server, and the server connects back to the client on port 113, and the server asks the client, hey, what's the username of the guy trying to connect to me on these ports? The reason it's primitive is because the client can lie and say anything he wants to say. So you don't see this used very often, but some IRC clients still use this port to try to authenticate the user. So, he also, this administrator, looked at firewall logs in the outbound direction. He actually had logging enabled. And he noticed that this system infected within the perimeter is connecting to an unfamiliar system on the internet on port 6667. Anybody familiar with that port? Probably, yeah. IRC. It's one of the more common ports used for IRC chat. He, of course, scanned that system with several antivirus tools, but none of them reported anything suspicious, which is not all that uncommon. In most cases, if one of us gets involved with an analysis, probably antivirus wasn't all that helpful, because a lot of malware just doesn't get detected right away when we see it. It'll probably be detected a few days from now, but we've got to deal with the incident right now. So in this particular case, the administrator was asking his community for help because he posted this on the public mailing list, and he said, did anybody see something like this before? And some people reported, yeah, I've encountered this earlier. They talked about how port 6666 is used for IRC traffic. And because we're going to see IRC so frequently in the real world and in the classroom, I wanted to make sure that you're all familiar with what IRC is. In my mind, IRC is the grandfather of all chat networks. If you wanted to chat with some people using text, you install an IRC client that connects to the IRC server. And in many cases, IRC uses ports 6666 or 6667. Those are some of the more common ports that it uses. Could use other ones, of course. Let me explain to you the way IRC works from an architectural perspective, and you'll see why it is so common among malware authors to use the protocol. If you wanted to chat with some people in IRC, you have your client, let's say it's located behind a corporate firewall, making an outbound connection to the IRC server. And in most cases, organizations are very bad at blocking outbound traffic. So in many cases, this is going to succeed. And now you have a client talking to the IRC server. When other people want to chat with you, they connect to the same network of IRC servers using their own IRC clients. Now, in IRC, if you want to chat with somebody, you need to join a chat room, or IRC calls it a channel. And you join the channel based on your area of interest. So if you want to talk about butterflies, you join the butterfly channel. And then you join it. In your IRC client, you type a message. Hello, how is everybody doing? Press enter. Your IRC client sends that text message to the IRC server. And the IRC server relays that message to all the participants that are tuned into the same channel as you. And now, all the channel participants saw your message. Well, if you're writing a bot network, and you want a convenient way to remotely control all these infected systems across the internet, this IRC-based architecture works really well without you having to create and code your own protocol. Because if you program your bots to have a built-in IRC client, and you program them to connect to your own IRC server, to join your own IRC channel, then all you need to do is join that channel as a participant as well and start chatting with your bots. And as long as your chat messages contain the commands that the bots understand, the IRC server will be responsible for relaying those commands to all the bots. So that's why you still see IRC used a lot. I mean, people have been using IRC to control bot networks for so long, and it's still going very strong. So we'll look at some of those examples in the course. In this case, the malicious program, srvcp.exe, was connecting to a channel called micag. And in IRC, channel names are typically preceded with a pound or with a hash sign. So this is the channel that they were joining. And if you logged into that channel yourself, and you listed who are the people there, you would see hundreds of infected systems in there. And how did you know they were infected? Their name was set to I'm Trojan. So you see something like this? Yeah, probably something is not quite right in this particular situation. So, another thing that people on the mailing list reported was that they were able to look at the strings embedded into this program, and they noticed that it's got some suspicious-looking strings. Let's say one of the strings was successfully spawned ftp.exe. Now, when you see a string like this, you say, aha, I know what this program can do now. It probably is able to transfer files to and from the system using ftp.exe. Right? That's a pretty safe guess. And then you might see something like ready and willing. And you say, well, ready and willing, what could that be? Is it ready and willing to accept commands from the attacker? Is it ready and willing to attack somebody else? My point is that by just looking at strings like this, you really don't quite know what the strings are about. And in fact, you don't really know whether these strings are tied to the actual functionality programmed into the executable. Maybe the malware author is just trying to confuse you and mislead you and built in the string, and maybe in reality this program has nothing to do with ftp.exe. But what I just described to you on these last few slides is really the extent of the analysis that most people feel comfortable doing. Right? They look at some firewall logs, they scan the system with an antivirus tool, they look at the built-in strings. But this analysis is not enough for us to really understand the role of this malicious executable within the incident. Where did it come from? Why is it here? Who is controlling it? What are its capabilities? Those are the types of questions that we want to answer. And that's really what the course is about. What this course is about is taking a situation like this and digging into it much deeper so that we have many more answers that have been confirmed to be reasonably accurate. So this is the type of a situation we're going to be examining. And to be able to examine it, I wanted to talk about how we set up the lab within which we can examine these malicious executables. Because in most cases, we will be using and looking at compiled malicious executables. We don't have source code to them. We just got to figure out what are they about. And here's the lab. Here's the lab that I find allows you to answer questions like this. If you haven't noticed already, all the slides that I'm showing you are also in your book. So especially in situations where you might not be able to see some of the details in the slide, just take a look at the book. You should be able to see a corresponding page number at the bottom right corner of my screen. So here's the approach that I find works for me, and I'm not just teaching you my approach. This is what a lot of malware analysts find very useful. The approach involves setting up an isolated laboratory environment within which you can infect one of your own systems and examine what's going on within that system. To examine what's going on there, you got to have the right monitoring tools, and we're going to set those up. You want to be able to monitor the file system, the registry, the network, but also you want to have tools that allow you to perform some analysis of the code that comprises the executable. We're going to be talking about those tools as well. And what I find very useful is to approach the analysis in two distinct phases. One of the phases is called behavioral analysis. And this is where we're learning and observing the behavior of the specimen. We infect one of our laboratory systems and we just look to see what happens. But when I say we look to see what happens, this really oversimplifies things. We don't just sit back, open a beer and, you know, relax and look at the logs. We actually end up interacting with the program to encourage it to exhibit behavior that's worth observing. I'm going to show you how to do that. And at some point, we'll probably see all there is to see behaviorally about the program, but probably we will not have answered all the questions about its capabilities. That's why there's the second phase, which is code analysis. Two distinct phases. Now, how many of you here have strong programming backgrounds, feel comfortable in assembly, let's say? A few people have that background. And that looks like a very typical sampling. Most people taking this course are not strong programmers. Rather, they have some network or systems level experience before, but some people have some programming background as well. The reason I ask is because which phase you begin your analysis with really depends on where your strengths lie. And so if you have a strong programming background, if you know assembly inside out, you feel comfortable looking at a disassembler, then you probably will prefer to begin with code analysis. And then supplement the gaps in your understanding by doing some behavioral analysis. But because I know that most people taking this course have their background in networks and systems, in the exercises in this course, we're going to begin with behavioral analysis. And also that's something that comes more naturally to me because my background is based on system administration type staff stuff. So in the course, we're going to begin with behavioral analysis because I know it's going to work best for most people in the class. But really, outside of the course, start with whichever you feel most comfortable with. To do behavioral analysis, we'll need to have a network system because most malware that you're going to be analyzing is going to be wanting to do something on the network. It'll maybe try to update itself or download configuration files, or it's going to try to leak out data, or it's going to try to scan the network to try to infect other systems, or it's going to report the coordinates of the infected system back to the attacker. Modern malware is very much about the network. That's why we've got to have a network in our lab. And what systems do you have in your lab? Well, as you can see here, I like having several different flavors of Windows because malware will behave differently depending on the particular version of Windows that you have. Now, most malware that I have seen and that I end up analyzing is built to run under Windows XP. That's by far the most platform out there. That's what attackers target because they know this is what their victims are going to be running, Windows XP. Windows 7 is gaining in popularity. Very few enterprises have rolled it out yet as far as I could see, but it's in their plans. That means we're going to start seeing some malware targeting Windows 7. I have not seen one yet. Most malware that I've analyzed works really well under Windows XP. It's going to need to be adjusted a bit for Windows 7 because it is a more resilient OS. Yes. Yeah, Vista. You know what? This slide used to say Windows Vista, and then I just realized nobody runs Vista. And so Vista, most enterprises just skipped it, forget it. It's like it never even was out there. But Windows 7, I mean, yeah, a lot of people are looking at it. Yeah. So we're going to look at some examples on day three of, let's say, the way user mode rootkits work and the way DLL injection works. those techniques are going to be designed for Windows 7, the attackers will need to figure out how to adjust them. I'm sorry, those techniques are designed for Windows XP. The attackers will need to figure out how to adjust them for Windows 7. But we're going to be focusing this course Windows XP because that's what everybody else is focusing on. At some point, we'll look at Windows 7. You will notice that also in my lab I have a Linux box. It's not because I use it very much to analyze Linux malware, but because this is where I perform most of my web-based malware analysis. You'll see why. Well, because there's some really good tools that run really well into Linux. And also because this is the box that I use to emulate various network services that malware is trying to reach. Yeah. Well, so the question is the diagram that we're looking at, should it represent a physical network or a virtual network? Because there's a lot of convenience of using virtualization, but some malware is going to look to see if it's running in a virtualized environment. Let me hold off on answering that question comprehensively, because I will touch upon it several times today. Of course, the diagram that you're looking at, it's a logical representation of your lab, and you can choose to implement it using physical hardware or virtualization. Of course, in this course, we're going to be using virtualization because it just makes it easier to do things like this in a single lab, in a single laptop or a single PC. So, but to answer your question, I typically do this work in a virtualized environment, but I do have physical systems on standby when I feel like I need to jump onto a physical lab. We'll revisit that topic later on. When I do want to virtualize this lab, I end up using VMware. Now, there are a lot of virtualization choices out there. You've got ZenWorks, you've got Sun VirtualBox, you've got Microsoft Virtual PC. I use VMware because, you know, when I started doing this, that was the only option available to me. And since then, the platform has continued to mature. Most of the people that I talk to use VMware, so it ends up being kind of self-reinforcing. But of course, you end up using whatever you feel most comfortable with, whatever you have a software license for. In this course, we're going to be using VMware. It's a pretty mature platform. I haven't had any major problems with it. It works, and a lot of analysts use it. Of course, from a convenience perspective, you can't beat virtualization. It allows us to have multiple physical boxes, logical boxes running on the same physical hardware. So in the screenshot, you see I've got a Linux virtual machine running in the background in one of the tabs. I've got a Windows XP box in another tab. I've got another instance of XP running in the background as well. Very convenient, because now we can bring up multiple systems in a single physical chassis. It's nice. We can use a single keyboard and mouse to interact with all of them. If we want to, we can share a clipboard. If we want to and feel safe, we can drag and drop files. Convenient. Also, another convenient feature of a virtualization platform like VMware is that it can emulate the network. So your virtualized lab does not need to be plugged into any physical network. VMware calls this host-only networking. So in this class, that's what we're going to use. We're going to configure our virtual machines to use the virtualized host-only network. All the virtual systems will be able to talk to each other, but they won't be able to talk to the outside world. And that's how we like it. We like having this environment nice and isolated. It's safer that way, and it also gives you more control. And I'm going to show you why that is very useful shortly. So yeah, the diagram that I showed you, I end up usually implementing this lab using a virtualized network. VMware calls the virtualized hosts guests. And the physical hardware, it calls it the host. So all these virtualized machines, if you read VMware documentation, it's going to call them guests. So in this class, what I asked you to do is come prepared with a single virtualized machine that you needed to build running Windows XP. That's the one we're going to infect. And later today, I'm going to give you a Linux virtual machine that I already prepared, and we're going to configure them to talk to each other so that we can use them, well, to analyze malware. Now, one thing you got to be very careful about when doing this sort of work is how isolated your lab is from the production environment, because, well, it can be really dangerous for your career if you have malware that you're analyzing escape onto your corporate production network. So, you know, we take some extra precautions, such as don't plug your laboratory physical host into your production network. if you need it to be connected to the internet because you're doing some internet-based research, you know, have a separate DSL line that's not affiliated with your organization that you can plug your lab into, for example. Or sometimes I end up using a wireless broadband card. If you're using a product like VMware, you need to make sure that you keep it patched. Now, this is annoying because did you recently download a copy of VMware Workstation? How big was that download? Anybody done that recently? It was like half a gig. And if VMware notifies you that there's an update to it, how big is that update? Half a gig. Because you just have to, you download that half a gig executable, it ends up uninstalling the previous installation of VMware, reinstalls it again. Nobody wants to do it. It's annoying, it's a pain. But unfortunately, we gotta do it because VMware does fix various security vulnerabilities that under some circumstances could introduce risk into your configuration. There have been some vulnerabilities that could allow, for example, an escape from a virtual machine to another virtual machine or into your physical host. So keep in mind that if you're virtualizing systems, that is not as reliable as having separate, physically distinct systems. Keep VMware up to date. If possible, don't use that host for anything else. Now, I have seen plenty of malware that checks to see whether it's running in a virtualized environment, but I have not seen anything myself that actually tries to escape from it. But it's not inconceivable, so be careful. One of the most convenient features of VMware Workstation, and it might sound like I'm selling this product, I have no affiliation with VMware. In fact, I asked them to give me a free copy of the tool so I can use it for educational purposes, and they refused. But it's just a very good tool, and specifically VMware Workstation. VMware Workstation is convenient in that it supports the feature of multiple snapshots. Now, a lot of virtualization tools allow you to click a button, and it remembers the state of your system. It's very convenient, because even if you mess it up, you infect your box, you rootkit it, I mean, it's awful, you can't restore it back, but because you took a snapshot, you click a single button, and it's back to its pristine state. Very convenient. VMware Workstation supports many, many of these snapshots. So, in the screenshot here, for example, you see that I took one screenshot some months ago, then I took another snapshot. That's why I end up using the commercial tool, VMware Workstation, that costs a couple of $100s, even though they have a free version of their tool called VMware Server. The biggest limitation? VMware Server supports only one snapshot. For malware analysis, I find it very convenient to take multiple snapshots. So here's what I typically do. I install the operating system from scratch. Maybe even before I patch it, I take a snapshot. And then every few months or so, as I apply the latest updates, I take another snapshot. The reason this is convenient is because if I'm analyzing malware that I think is targeting a particular vulnerability that maybe was in existence a few months ago, I can revert back to the snapshot when my virtualized system was vulnerable to that exploit, and I can see what would happen. So these multiple snapshots are really convenient. Also, in the lab, you might be taking multiple snapshots throughout your analysis, so that if you want to repeat some of your steps, you don't have to go all the way to the beginning of your analysis. So, very convenient feature. And VMware Workstation is one of the few products that supports these multiple snapshots. Now, some malware does not like running in a virtualized environment. And I'm going to show you some of those examples a little bit later today. So if you do use a physical lab, it's wonderful. Unless you have to have that lab portable and you lug it around with you. But if you don't need it to be portable, physical lab is very convenient. The biggest thing that you miss is these multiple snapshots. So here are a few suggestions for you. If you end up implementing your lab using a physical system, how do you revert back to a known state after you're done with your analysis? What a lot of people do is they set up their physical box to have multiple partitions. So a copy of the original partition is somewhere on the local drive, and when they're done with their analysis, they would use a tool like Ghost or DD to clone the clean partition onto the one that they've just infected. That's convenient. Many organizations, rather than storing the pristine image locally, end up storing it somewhere in the network. If you do use the DD approach, you might like this one tool that I came across called DDP that allows you to only transfer the differences across the two partitions rather than having to copy one big partition. So DDP ends up kind of applying a patch and is a bit more efficient to use. So this is the most common way of reverting to a known state if you're using physical drives. Something else that some organizations use is software that supports this idea of snapshots. So they might take a physical system for their lab, and then they would install into it a tool like Windows Steady State. Windows Steady State allows you to click a button, and it'll remember the state of the system, and then when you're done with your analysis, you can click another button and revert back to the state that it remembered. It's actually a free tool from Microsoft, and surprisingly few organizations realize that it exists. You've got some commercial tools as well, like Returnal, and the most popular one is probably Deep Freeze. They're inexpensive, like $10 per license per workstation, something like that. Most of these tools, well, many of these tools, are marketed towards public internet kiosk environments. You know, if you're a university, you're setting up a public PC in a library, you know that at the end of the day, that PC is going to be completely messed up. And so you might use software like Windows Steady State to revert back to the way it was. But we can use the same feature for our lab as well. But keep in mind that this is software-based snapshotting. There are ways that malware could bypass its protection. It could terminate the process associated with these tools. It can find the file where it saves the snapshot state and try to mess with it. There was, for example, one case with Deep Freeze that I have seen where Deep Freeze at the time, I don't know if they fixed that problem before, it did not properly revert the master boot record. So you had a system that you infected, and it would copy its malicious code into the master boot record of the hard drive. Then you click Deep Freeze to restore back to the clean state, but it did not restore the master boot record, so the system got reinfected. So keep in mind these limitations, and if you use one of these tools, test them out before you rely on them too much. Perhaps the best option, the best of both worlds, is this one of these cards that you might be able to buy. Here's an example, for example, of a card called Core Restore. You've got a Reborn PCI card that does something similar. The idea behind these cards is that you place them between the motherboard and the hard drive. And they are able to journal the changes that you make to the drive and allow you to revert to a trusted state of the drive with a few commands. Kind of like what these software tools do, but implemented in hardware. And this is not expensive. For example, Core Restore was less than $200. Most organizations can afford to spend that on a malware analysis lab. Here's the downside. Good luck finding one of these in the stores now. Sadly, I contacted the manufacturer of Core Restore, and they have not been selling this for about a year anymore. I think the market for which these were made, I mean, maybe it's just not there anymore. They can't make any money selling these tools. So Core Restore gave me some story about how they're working on a better version of their card, but I have yet to see one come out. Same thing with their Reborn PCI card. These are still out there. Your best bet is probably finding them on eBay. Maybe some internet cafes have purchased them and don't need them anymore. So great tools for our purpose, a little bit hard to find. Kind of like, I don't know, network hubs are becoming obsolete now. Yeah. You put everything in what? HP 8. So you're using a host protected area, HP 8. I'm not familiar with that. Is that a feature of a hard drive controller or is that a special tool? Uh-huh. That sounds perfect. So John is saying that some hard drive controllers, I guess not all, I suspect, support the HPA feature. Layer ATA drives support the HPA feature that allow you to set off a partition and then restore back its previous state. I'm going to look into that. Let me write it down. Thank you. So HPA feature of some hard drives or their controllers. And of course, another option is to use the various... there are a lot of options, especially in the world of physical drive forensics, where you can easily clone drives, that you've got very fast tools. Most people that do malware analysis, what they end up doing is use virtualized labs. If they're not virtualized, then they try to get their hands on one of these controllers, or they use steady state, or they use disk cloning. But look, it sounds like there are some interesting options available out there, like HPA. So that's the kind of lab we want to have. We've got a lab that allows us to run multiple operating systems that can talk to each other, that are isolated from the internet. We have a way of reverting back to a clean state once we're done with the analysis. Now, what can we do with this? Well, let's see this approach in action. And the way I'm going to do this is I'm going to walk you through an analysis that I performed and show you the tools that I use as the analysis unfolds. And then, closer to lunchtime, we're going to set up our lab, and the example that I have for you in the afternoon will allow you to try this approach in your lab under my guidance. That's really the plan for today. I'm going to start out with a behavioral analysis. And for this example, I'm going to use the same executable that I talked about earlier this morning, the one with a strange name of srvcp.exe. We've got a copy of that executable. Now, where malware analysis begins in my world is where you had somebody perform incident response and copy the malicious executable out of the system that is infected. Or you had somebody perform hard drive forensics and identified an executable on the drive that they think is suspicious, so they copied it and they brought it to you. So where our work begins in this course, in most cases, is where somebody has given you an executable that they think is malicious, and they're asking you to take a look at it to understand what it might be capable of. So we're not talking about the area of forensics where we're performing hard drive analysis to find that executable. The work of this course begins where you already have that executable and you want to understand what it's about. The way we're going to do behavioral analysis is copy this executable into our lab. We've got one of these Windows XP systems we're going to infect. That system has the necessary monitoring tools installed in it. I'm going to show you those tools shortly. I'm going to activate those monitoring tools. I'm going to double-click and infect my box with the program. And I'm going to let it run for a few minutes. Just give it enough time to do something that's worth observing. Then I'm going to pause my monitoring tools, terminate the malicious process as possible, and start looking through the logs to understand what just happened. A lot of the monitoring tools we're going to be using are available for free from Microsoft. So a while back, Microsoft bought a little company called SysInternals that was developing really awesome tools. And fortunately for us, Microsoft continues to develop and make these tools available for free. The two tools that I want to start with are Process Monitor and Process Explorer. And this is Process Monitor in action. What does it do? Well, it monitors processes, but more specifically, it shows you several types of API calls that these processes make related to the way they access the file system, the registry, and the way they interact with other processes. And it runs on the actual system that you're infecting, and it collects this information in real time. Now, if you've ran one of these tools before, you will notice that it fills up its log very quickly. Well, rather, the log doesn't fill up. You probably do have enough disk space. But the log grows very, very quickly because Windows generates events and accesses the file system all the time. And that's normal. So you got this huge log file, and then you will start looking through it to find those things that matter to you. Those things are interesting. So what I'm showing you on the slide is a set of events that I thought was interesting. And if you can't see them on the screen, they're in your book on page 29. As you can see, Process Monitor creates a line per event that it observed. There's a column that gives you the timestamp. There's a column that shows you what process name the event was associated with. And then it tells you the operation that they saw that process perform. In our example, that operation is called create file. Then there's the path column that shows you what file the operation was operating on. So when I first saw this, I misinterpreted. I got a little confused, and I wanted to make sure that you don't get confused the way that I did. I saw the operation called create file, and I first thought that what it's doing is it's creating a file under System32 called gus.ini. But if you look at the detail column on the right side of the screen, you will notice that actually this access is really a generic read. It's just a badly named API call. It's called create file, but it doesn't always create. Sometimes it reads only. So I'm mentioning this to you because don't just go by the name of the operation. Do take some time to look at the detail column to see what are the details for this operation. So what you see on the screen is the file, is the process called srvcp.exe, attempting to read a file called gus.ini, and the result is that that name is not found. So when you have a log like this in front of you, you'll see a ton of noise, lots and lots of events, most of them not meaningful for you. And you need to think what to pay attention to. Any ideas why I thought these particular events are worth thinking about or worth mentioning to you? Any ideas why these and not others? What to you would indicate that this is something that you think might be associated with malicious programs? Yes. Absolutely, yes. I mean, first of all, you are paying attention to what to the operations originating from the malicious process that we're analyzing. Yes. Yep. Yeah. That's very good because that'll eliminate a ton of other noise. Now, keep in mind, and you'll see this when you experiment with the tool later today, the malicious process will be also making other API calls that are quite normal that all Windows programs initiate. So you have eliminated a ton of noise, but there's still some noise for you to sift through. Yeah, but you're right. We're paying attention to events associated with a malicious process. Anything else that's a little bit weird here? Oh, it's reading an ini file. Yeah, so the fact that the file is named .ini suggests to you that maybe it's a config file, and I'm interested in seeing that. Another reason why this stood out was that it's reading a file that I have never seen before. So you're looking for these kinds of anomalies. Gus.ini, never seen that before. Maybe it's because I'm just ignorant. So you Google it. Maybe you look at one of the normal systems. Nope, does not look like a normal box should have gus.ini. It's another reason why it was a little bit strange to me. Yeah. And it's a file in System 32, which we're a bit protective about. So yes, that's another reason why you might look at this. So as you can see, you're looking for things that are a bit anomalous to you, that stand out. Now, this finding in itself is pretty meaningful, because what I did when I saw this is I went back to the incident, to the real-world infected box, and I found that it did have a file called the gus.ini. So this file was present on the infected system. And that shows you one of the benefits of being able to do things like that. It allows you to know what else to look for that maybe initially you did not realize was in scope of your investigation. So that's what goes through your mind when you're looking at these logs.